Welcome to the Education Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsor, Limmer Education, we can make science more accessible and understandable. Well, hello and welcome everyone to the March 2025 Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Education Research Journal Club. The PCRF promotes research literacy to advance the science of EMS educational research. So here with the PCRF Journal Club, we're going to take a closer look at some of the latest research happening in medical education. Thank you to Limmer Education for sponsoring these podcasts so we can bring you the best of science in education. I'm Megan Corey, and I'm here with David Page. Joining us soon will be Dr. Bill Toon. And today we're going to bring you an interesting article. This was published this year, and it's entitled "The Effects of Clinical Practice Stress, Stress Coping, and Empathy on Clinical Competency Among Paramedic Students." And we'll talk a little bit about the article itself and the journal. And maybe some, this is coming out of Korea, and it's in a journal that I hadn't heard of before, looked up and we looked up some of the references and thought, well, the subject matter is pretty interesting, but it's also raises some issues about, you know, what kind of research is going on around the world that maybe we don't have access to because there's issues with translation. So we'll talk about some of that as we go along. And remember that if you ever miss any of these, or you have to leave early, or you're going to, you know, we are interested in looking at some of our past podcasts, you can always go to our YouTube channel. It's youtube.com/@PCRF@UCLA. And you can look up the Education Research Journal Club, the PCRF Clinical Research Journal Club, and watch some of the prior episodes, which is a great way to get right into that research. But before we actually get into the research, I want to bring David Page on. We're going to talk about some of the great stuff happening in 2025 and what that's happened. I mean, we've already lots and lots and lots of research going on this year involving lots of people. And I'm just going to send out a little plug that two of my students just got accepted to the upcoming April Research Summit. So I'm really excited. It's paramedic students involved in research. This is the way to do it. David.
Well, I am so excited. It's really a banner year for PCRF. We keep setting bigger and better records, and I think it's just amazing. I don't want to let this moment go without saying, you know, putting one of those little plugs for those of you who have research just laying around, just sitting there on a table, ready to be finished. Like a little project that was supposed to happen, that maybe was going to happen, and tell you that the deadline here is coming up in June, at the end of June. So please send us your abstracts. We want your abstracts. And we're very excited to getting to for Indianapolis here come September, October 20th through 24th is the next time that we'll see abstracts being presented. We had a record year last year, over 82 abstracts submitted, which, so for anybody who's thinking there's no research in EMS, think again. There's more than you think. And really good stuff. That's it's not just about quantity, it's about the depth of the and the quality. So banner year that way, but also we are blessed to have incredible partners. Limmer Creative, especially our sponsor for this podcast and webinar, and our sponsors of the workshops. And so we have not just two workshops that we that are in progress already for equity. Research that is happening out of California, funded by CareStar, looking at equity and inequities in care, in pre-hospital delivery of care, and workforce delivery of education, et cetera. We also were blessed to just conduct one in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, sponsored by Weinmann, really focused on airway ventilation, and that has some incredible abstract coming out. We're just poised to do the ESO workshop in May here in Austin. And this graphic here that you're seeing is actually an exciting opportunity that is currently open right now. Operators are standing by. Well, Google is standing by with a form, but for you to register, there is no cost to these workshops, just the cost of whatever it's going to take for you to get there. We often feed you quite well, maybe too much. And the one in Buffalo here coming up is related to trauma and particularly disasters, but it's pretty open. NEMSIS is funding it through a grant from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, and the State Office of EMS in New York. And we have great support from ImageTrend and ESO, our data partners, to really be able to answer questions. So if you don't know about this format, arrive curious, arrive with a question, leave with an abstract. It's pretty exciting. And we might finish the year with six or seven of these workshops. But there's at this point, you can hold the date secret, but save the date for September. If you can't make this June one, we'll have one in September in Austin with ESO again, and that's September 22nd, I believe.
Yeah,
22nd,
22nd through the 24th.
yeah.
Right.
So that's a little street secret. The registration's not yet open, coming soon to a website near you. Prehospitalcare.org is a website, and amazing work being done by all of the different mentors, mentees, the data partners, and I mean, where can you go to find out that the one of the past ones was diltiazem? Of and its use in pre-hospital care, and whether that actually results in better outcomes, which it did, and like less length of stay and no danger, no bad sequela. So databases that are connected to outcomes are unbelievable. So it's very cool. Never before have we had these, and it's really, really cool. So that is what's happening at PCRF, and we're excited to have you join us at one of these workshops if you can.
Great, thank you. Someone's commenting that the link to the article today isn't working, so we'll try and straighten that out for you because we have it's an open access article. But yeah, great things happening at Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum and at these research summits. We're growing, the next generation of researchers, which I think is great. And we're also just supporting the researchers who are already out there, who are becoming mentors to those who are just starting. So that's great. Thanks, Dave. And we just had Dr. Bill Toon join us too. Welcome, Bill. Happy to have you here. This article that we're going to be looking at today is not an easy read. I'm going to warn you about this. It was we chose it and chose it because of the topic, the subject matter. These are looks like it was PhD candidates that produced this, that it was some type of graduate work. And this is published out of the Republic of Korea. It's in a journal, which I'm not going to, I know Dave could pronounce this beautifully, Cuestiones de Fisioterapia. I don't know how to say that. But this journal, I'm not sure exactly where that one comes out of, but it is, I looked up their website. And the one thing that's, I'm going to tell you when you read it, it's a challenge at first because the translation, I think there were some stressors with the translation or some difficulties with the translation. But I read it a couple of times So I could kind of get to understanding. I think there were some areas where clinical practice and clinical performance may have been kind of confused a little bit. But I wanted to bring this up because we want all research. We want to hear what's going on everywhere. And oftentimes that means that research has to be translated. And, you know, in the opposite sense, maybe you have research and you would like to bring it to another place in the world where you'd like it translated. So I wanted to ask David how, because you have so much international experience, how that might work if and let's start with, let's say I have some research. I'd like it to spread the word in a Latin American country, but I don't speak Spanish and I don't know how to translate it, and I'm certainly not going to use Google Translate. How do I translate my research for to submit to another journal where it's a Spanish language journal or some other language?
Well, actually, that's amazing. It's an amazing journey into how academic work gets published. And Cuestiones de Fisioterapia is
Thank you.
the journal here. It's a Spaniard kind of thing, but it is sort of fun to see a Korean paper published out of a journal that's actually primarily in Spanish, but they're in English because the language of medicine across the world really has been and become or is in English or in French. So in some of the African countries that speak French, Francophone Africa, that the French system of medicine was really propagated. So, but in Asia, because this is my own thought, but it's going to be hard for everybody to learn each other's languages from all these different countries. English is the operative language for, especially for medical purposes. So often nursing schools and medical, always medical schools, but nursing schools and even paramedic schools are in English, even in countries where that is not necessarily the native language. So fascinating to encounter this. Latin America is different. The training is often in Spanish, but publication in English is very, very common. So having to translate your article into English. So it's pretty normal, actually, to
Yeah.
see these, and the degree to which the English is shared, we create a shared image of what it is that we're trying to communicate. The editors may not be primarily English speaking or English language learners. They may have limited English proficiency, but it's interesting when somebody is, thinking they talk the same language, but maybe they're talking across. So you're absolutely right. There's some questions in here that I had about, did you really actually mean that? And EMT and paramedic is often intertwined. So the concept of EMT in Korea is definitely one where you'd have to really look and see if it's a paramedic in our world or an EMT. I was super thrilled that this is coming from a university that has a paramedicine department, and they've embraced Asia has embraced the Australian model in many cases where an entire department is formed, even within graduate schools, to offer PhDs in paramedicine. And the term paramedicine and paramedic is adopted universally, which I hope EMS will do in the US, but at the moment it hasn't.
Yeah, that's another reason this is graduate work. You can see that one of the authors is a PhD candidate, another one says student. So I thought that was very interesting too, and something to highlight. So is it possible that something could go two languages as well, go from Korean to Spanish to English?
Sometimes it's more common, I think, to see articles go from a non-English language to an English language, we could actually submit to Emergencia, which is a Spaniard journal, and we used to take pre-hospital emergency care and translate it into Emergencia in Spanish. These are often, at least the ones that are non-indexed in Latin America, it wouldn't make sense to try and get it out into Spanish if it's not going to be indexed. It's more common to have it come back this into English. Even in Europe, some of the journals that are Scandinavian, the Scandinavian Journal of Trauma, really have adopted the English language for that journal. So, more common to see others translate to English than take an English language journal or article and try and put it into another journal. Especially because impact factor, I'm sure all of the listeners know, but and it's actually changing. Impact factor was always measured by how many people cited your work. So if people are, commenting on something and they cite your work, that's a metric that people want to see, especially if it's in other research. Today, altmetrics and other forms of metrics are leading us to see just how much people are quoting it in social media, and that helps your altmetrics so that the social media exposure to some of the articles that we see helps the author gain a bit more, and the journal gains more, and therefore is ranked. Pre-hospital emergency care is a top tier, top 10 journal, and it's the journal that is the official journal of NAMSP, NAEMT, NREMT, NAMSE. So all of the EMS folks kind of point to it. If your journal, you should shoot for the highest ranked journal first, because it's going to get more impact factor, more people will see it, more prestige. So it's often you shoot for the highest level, and then you get knocked out or knocked down or rejected, go to the next one, go to the next one. So it would make sense that people are in general going for those top tier journals that are in English.
Interesting. Dr. Toon, you were unmuting for there. Do you have something
Yes.
to
Well,
add?
it's hard to get a word in when Dave is talking, so I just like picking on you, Dave. So, one of the things that you commented about with the term paramedic or paramedicine, I thought it was interesting. If I have found again in my little history search I'm doing, prior to 1970, the term paramedic or paramedic personnel was applied to the new breed of physician's assistant, advanced nurse practitioners. It was a really universal word, and it was not just specific to what we think of as a paramedic now. So that's something that changed, once the curriculums rolled out, both the EMT and the paramedic curriculum, and that sort of codified those terms and pulled them away from those other professions. So I found that interesting in doing work that I would read paramedic and I says, this person isn't working what I think is a current paramedic level. So that's just something that when you read something prior to 1970, you would be surprised that that term is pretty universally thrown around for someone other than a paramedic.
Paramedical and paramedic in Latin America is still that way, and they have trouble with that term, in fact. So, in especially in countries that have adopted a supposed Franco-German model that is supposedly physicians on every ambulance, which is never really actually true, the say Colombian and Argentinian systems, when you use the word paramedic, it's almost like you're a dental hygienist. That's, paramedical.
Great. Well, let's dive into this article here. So what they started, the reason they came to, studying this, and this is another thing that's a little interesting about this journal is there's not a whole lot of space spent on deep background and some descriptions of like the system, the practice, or anything. And that's why we're left with these questions. So that would actually have helped, I think, in this one to describe that a little bit deeper. But they did describe that some of the research that supported the research questions. So the empathy and self-regulation ability, coping, we know tends to reduce stress. We know this in some of the studies in clinical practice. Students that have a clinical practice, whether it's medical students or nursing students or paramedic students, but not a whole lot's known about the clinical practice stress, the stress that's occurred there, and its potential impact on paramedic students. It raised a question to me, or an issue to me, Ryan Battenhorst. I don't know if people are familiar with Ryan, but he's been presenting, and he's now Dr. Ryan Battenhorst. He's been presenting his research around at different conferences on the impact of clinical rotations on, you know, post-traumatic stress in paramedic students. So that reminded me of his, this sort of reminds me of some of the work that he has done and is now talking about. I would recommend looking him up and looking up some of his research, or checking out some of the work that he's done and is doing at different conferences or presenting at different conferences. So this group wanted to look at this sort of a similar thing. They had three research questions, but there was one that I think that was sort of either lost in translation or left out because it's actually in the results. So they wanted to examine clinical practice stress, stress coping, and empathy according to the demographics of paramedic students. So we'll see that they measure clinical practice stress, stress coping, empathy, and then they look at the different demographics, interesting categories of demographics too, of paramedic students. Then they wanted to identify or examine the relationship between empathy and stress coping ability of paramedic students and identify factors affecting clinical practice stress among paramedic students. What they left out in the research question is something that's actually in their tables, which I think is the most interesting question, is what about the impact on clinical performance? So they actually look at these factors and how do they impact clinical performance? And I thought that was interesting as somebody who teaches paramedic students. These are, you know, modifiable risk factors for improving clinical performance. If we're talking about things like clinical practice stressors, how can we, if they impact clinical performance, these are modifiable kind of risk factors for poor clinical performance, if that's what's found out. So what they looked at were 194 paramedic students in Korea. These were questionnaires. So that's something to remember too, especially when it gets to clinical performance, we're talking about self-reported. So these are questionnaires that have certain items. You'll see in the next page, the Cronbach's Alpha, the validation of their clinical, of their questionnaires. But this is sort of the characteristics. Table one is the characteristics of the study subjects. So they looked at gender, and we have, you know, a majority being female. Again, that might get to what you guys were talking about what is the field? Is this, you know, are we talking about EMTs and paramedics, and are there really more? That's very unusual to see more female than male, although I'm not sure, Dave or Bill, if you're more familiar with the Korean, you know, the breakdown of gender among EMS providers in Korea.
I don't. I'm not. I will say that most of the ambulance services that are, as we would think of them, emergency 911 ambulances are fire department based, and it would floor me to think that this would be an extremely odd thing, because I think that most fire services around the world are are male dominated.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many hospital-based ambulance services that are going to have a much stronger mix. It doesn't surprise me. This is a university-based program, and mm-hmm. therefore we're not talking about firefighters being trained to be paramedics. It's more in an academic setting. So I did think that, you know, it was great to see so many women and really cool. It also, did you notice there, most of them are like 49% are living in a dorm.
Yeah.
So,
didn't you think these categories were interesting though, too? Some of them I would not have thought of. You know, yeah. When we see demographics and categories, we see things like gender and race and years working in the field and, you know, things like that. Here we're seeing religion, which I thought was interesting. But that, which is actually a good question, because it might, these are, again, they're looking at empathy, stress coping. They wanted to, think about what kind of things might impact that answer, that outcome. So very interesting question. Living arrangement. Were they in the dorm or at home or living alone or living? I mean, that was, I thought that was interesting. Clinical, number of clinical practices. I'm not sure if that was that one. And which one? The certificate of BLS providers. Are those proxies for experience? What we would measure as years of experience, or whether or not you've been an AEMT first, or, I mean, is that, are those
Or
proxies?
just have CPR. I mean, a BLS certificate might just mean you have a CPR certification, or it might mean that you were an EMT before you went to paramedic school. It's really hard to tease out what they mean, and that's part of what's lost in translation. The number of clinical practices, is that the number of jobs they have, or the number of different, patient contacts they've had, or shifts they've had? Because that is also confusing.
I think it was shifts. If I remember right, there was something in there that said, somewhere in the body of the writing, I think I remember it saying, if someone had one rotation, versus how many different, experiences they
Yeah,
had.
and 21% had greater than three, equal or greater than three. So does that mean that most of these students are doing one to two shifts? And
Before this
you know,
questionnaire.
yeah,
And then a question I actually highlighted and put, I love this, is that they asked about why they chose the field. I think that's a great question. Not just, we ask a lot about the next two, satisfaction. Are you satisfied with your practice and the choice of the major? But what made you come here? I think that's a great question. And the categories they had was, just was a good fit. There's good employment opportunities, so high job placement rates. So I chose that, or my high school grades or whatever said well, and I don't know what that means. Does that mean my high school grades said you should probably choose paramedic, or is it say you'd be a good fit for paramedic,
Or just
which,
in high school, yeah, they heard about it, and that's how they thought, that's why they went.
and
And
then
there's
others
not a lot of
recommended.
satisfaction, right? I mean, 33% are averagely satisfied, so not necessarily like, I mean, obviously some 40, 56% are very satisfied or satisfied. The majority are, but that's a high rate of I don't care.
It is. But the other one I really like is the choice of paramedic, under the choice of paramedicine, why did you choose it? Others recommended. I think that's an interesting one, especially because it kind of pans out later as the maybe that group. Although, again, once you get into these different categories, you get smaller and smaller numbers too, and the majority of them are in that good fit category, which could mean so many things. The measuring tools they use, these are the questionnaires, clinical practice stress items. There's, these are the number of items that are actually on it. And you'll see this in the tables. The tables are kind of huge. So we'll see individual tables for clinical practice stress coping, empathy, and clinical performance. And then the Cronbach's Alpha is a test of, reliability of these items. And, I don't know if you have any comments on this.
Just that it's strong, like all of that is, 94% confidence intervals, and they're this high reliability. So the internal test of the survey says it's a good survey. So that was nice.
Super important, so that you can then say, okay, these are good tools to use to begin with. And yeah, please, I forgot to say, we have the chat. If you haven't been here before, if you don't know, you can actually put your comments or questions or resources or whatever into the chat. And if you have anything you want to bring in to the conversation, please go ahead and throw it in there. All right, so
All right,
now
this
we're
is the money. This is the money right here.
gonna
Like, what? And a big number one, right? If I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing, I am going to be stressed out.
Yep.
Like,
I know I should
no,
have
really?
highlighted these, but this is the money. So there's a bunch of tables. There's like 14 tables in this, and they're kind of clustered. So the first two were the demographics and the tools that are used. The next ones are going to be the tables for each of those elements: clinical practice, stress, coping, empathy, and then clinical performance. Just looking at how these 194 or so students rated this, the clinical practice stress for each of these items. What were the source of clinical practice stress? And I know this is the money. So the top three,
Oh, the
drum
top,
roll,
like I would
please.
put the top five or seven in here
Yeah.
as this does not work. I don't know what
Yes.
I'm supposed to do,
I
right?
don't know what I'm going to do. They don't want me
They
here.
don't want me here, and what I got taught in class isn't what I'm actually doing
Yeah.
in practice. And like, how can that be so similar
Yeah.
in Korea as it is all across the world,
Yes.
especially in the US? Like,
Yes.
students standing in the ER going, I
Why
wasn't
am I here?
this. I don't know what to do here. And nobody wants me here. And they ignore me. I mean, like, all the way down to
Yeah.
number eight or nine, it's like, it's not, it's, I'm not supposed to be here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And equally important is what is not the source, but less commonly the source, right? So less commonly is I feel pressured to prepare for emergencies. No, I expect to feel pressured. How about I'm more stressed that you don't want me here than having a hostile patient or having physical threats from a patient. That's not stressful to
Like,
me.
I'm used to
You
that
not
part.
you being hostile to me as my
Well,
preceptor is more stressful than the patient being violent
we
toward
should have
me.
Likert scales. Which one are you most afraid of? A hostile preceptor or a hostile patient? And I will guarantee you, hostile preceptor wins every time.
Every time, every time. So, yeah, this one is definitely a table to sit on and
Oh.
look at.
And I'm sorry that the authors didn't actually list it in order.
Yeah, numerical order.
So it's kind of a an interesting, you have to really look at the numbers really carefully. Number one is hospital paramedics are not interested in
Yeah.
practicum students. So whoever it was, whether it's a paramedic or a nurse or the staff at the hospital, does not want practicum students. Is number one.
Yes. And
Yeah.
number two is unclear role and tasks. And number three is hospital paramedic ignores the student. So those are, again, that's the same way of saying the same thing. Number one source of clinical practice stress.
Yeah. And they did not, low on the list, though, maybe even lowest, is forming relationships with
Yeah.
patients. That's like,
Yeah.
yeah, of
Not a
all the things to be
stressor.
worried about, that's less. Yeah.
Yeah. So this was the clinical practice stress. So I thought that was interesting. I have to actually follow my paper on this one because, again, these tables don't, and I agree, if they put them in numeric order, it would have been a lot easier, rank order of which ones. So these are the coping mechanisms or the coping with stress. And so we see things like thinking about the problem from someone else's perspective, talking to someone who can help, realizing that I caused the problem. That bothered me a little bit, just a little bit. Maybe some personal responsibility there. So these were kind of coping mechanisms. And I think they found, or this is again just, I generally avoid socializing and staying alone. I ignore it and I pretend it didn't happen or very low. So these were, just again looking at responses to what were the students' idea of how they cope with stress.
I love
Oh,
the
sorry, let me go back.
self-regulation here on I don't let my feelings interfere too much with other things. Like it just I'm like a duck, it just rolls off of me. Because you would expect that exercise and sleep and those things, they knew were things that helped them with stress. so I like that. And I like that in at least in this culture, talking to someone
Yeah.
was a number, if not number one, like one or two here of like seek help, but just not letting it interfere. It
And
was like,
thinking about it from someone else's perspective, I thought that was very mature. So yeah, and that was number two, a close number two. So yeah, interesting. Now, empathy has been, we've talked about empathy scales and a lot. And I remember some of the early FISDAP research summits way back, we talked about empathy. So this one kind of, reminded me of some of the things that you've done in the past with empathy.
I was just going crazy about this because we did see, along with Dr. Williams at Monash, that empathy goes down as you go through paramedic school. So like if you measure it, the more you're in paramedic school, the less empathy you have, which is really counterintuitively horible. But here, you have high empathy. And again, unfortunately, they're not ranked, but you can see I try to put myself in my friend's shoes. Is one of the top ones. I try to consider the point of view of people who I disagree before before decision making. Again, very conscious and aware of their own biases, and really kind of strong. Trying to. I self-identify, I guess self-efficacy is what we ended up later in FISDAP looking more at instead of the concept of like the whether it's you're truly empathetic or you can portray empathy and hard to know what's in people's brains, but it's it's interesting. They had even when I watch a movie play, I feel like the main character. I'm like, I during movies too. The imagine about things that might happen to me was probably two or number three or four up top. Really kind of self-aware.
Yeah, I really wonder about the prompts. What was the prompt leading to all of these responses, especially in this one? So this is clinical performance. And I'm just curious, what is the prompt? Does it say, rank your clinical or score your clinical performance in these areas? Is that what the prompt is? And you have a 1 through 5 Likert scale, and then they've taken the mean and standard deviations of their responses. I mean, this one I was really interested in, but you can group, kind of cluster the types of responses, just like we did in the other, in the original, the first table. And this is another one I think is really interesting, because everything, all of the highest responses here are about like following the rules and, delegated practice. So you see, the highest one here is following the rules of the practicing organization, referring problems, accepting and improving on constructive criticism. I was happy to see. Considering a safe environment, measuring vital signs. These are like the ones that are, they're very kind of, how can I can follow the rules.
For clinical performance.
Technical, very technical, right? So you have other things that are in here that are, less clinical, creating a reassuring atmosphere when interacting with patients, is not a very high, it's 2.75. That's one of the ones that is lower. Actually, I think it's the lowest. Creating a reassuring atmosphere. So,
But they're
yeah.
very safety conscious. Look at the consider safe care environment. I agree, use of equipment and materials is just a little very technical, but I think the strongest one here, measure vital signs, was the strongest, right? So that's a very interesting technically based concept. But
Yeah.
yeah, I was also happy to see accepts and improves upon constructive
Criticism.
criticism. So
Yes.
that's a 3.8 and as high or nearly as high as some of the technical ones. So
I
not all.
wonder, yeah, I wonder this create and reassure atmosphere when interacting with patients, that low score, how much of this has to do with we really aren't taught that. That's not emphasized in my training, and so therefore I don't really feel like my clinical performance in that area is very, it's not emphasized. So it might actually be a reflection of these are the things that are emphasized in our training or in the environment where I'm at, in my clinical environment or by my
Yeah.
preceptor.
Well, and following protocol, I think no matter where you are in the world is considered a like you better do that. And so very protocol driven here and referring problems to faculty and others was also super highly rated there, 4.1 for
Yeah.
Brent 1.
So now we get to, now we have these individual tables of the results, and now we get to some of the association tables or the comparison by demographics. So there's like a set of four of them that they take each of these things, the clinical practice stress, the stress coping, empathy, and clinical performance, and they look at them by the demographics, by the different demographics, and see if look at kind of correlations. So this is the first one. And actually, did we look at, yeah, this is the first one where you see clinical practice stress, and then you see the categories, the different demographic categories, gender, religion, living arrangement, and all, and et cetera. And so the only two really that came out with statistical significance were the satisfaction of clinical practice and the satisfaction of the major. There was some association with a higher clinical practice stress. And which kind of makes a little bit of sense. If you're, well, I don't know. We don't want to say if they're less satisfied or dissatisfied with their choice, they'd have higher clinical practice stress, or is it more clinical practice stress? I'm not sure I understand that actually. This one
Yeah,
was
and the
the,
p-values really all kind of seem to
yeah.
point towards there was no
No.
statistical significance in the way that they broke this down. And I wasn't really sure where they were going with that, to be honest.
Yeah. The one thing I would love to know, again, this choice of paramedicine, I'm really obsessed with this idea that you're asking people why they chose the field. And there's no statistical significance here. But they did mention, in an area where others recommended, you saw the higher or lower clinical practice stress. So I thought that was an interesting note there. But again, just something I think I'd love to see more on why people choose the field and stay in the field and, association with things like clinical performance and clinical and stress and stress coping. So then there's the stress coping table, and you saw some gender related I think they said male students higher stress coping than female students in their questionnaires. And so this was up at the top, and no other statistical significance here. And then empathy. So empathy, again, this was we saw, and then now you flip that gender relationship and female students with
Isn't that
greater empathy.
incredible?
Yeah.
Right? So really interesting how they tried to fit that and ultra stereotypical, right? I mean,
Yeah.
men are supposed to cope better with stress, women are supposed to have more empathy, and I just worry that the tool might be actually
Little
biased at
bias.
that point. It's super apparent, traditional, or potentially biased. But notice how satisfaction of major and satisfaction of clinical
Yes.
practice were both statistically significant, but satisfaction of the major was actually more
Higher levels of empathy.
significant.
Yeah.
Yeah,
So students
so.
who are satisfied with their clinical training were more likely to be empathetic. Satisfied with their major had higher levels of empathy. And then female students and students who were satisfied with their clinical practice and major had higher empathy. So that's what they were noting in their results. And then clinical performance. So this one, again, I have a little note here, chicken or egg. You know, are you satisfied and therefore your clinical performance is improved, or is your clinical performance improved? You think your clinical performance is good and so you're satisfied. You know, which one? But the last two, satisfaction with clinical practice and satisfaction of the major, were the ones that were associated again with higher clinical performance. So that was an interesting note, but again, it's a chicken or egg thing. Which one comes first? So then the last three tables, these were the correlation tables. They did models. They did a couple of tables that that proving the model. But this was the big one, the correlation table between all three. I do believe that this is supposed to say clinical practice at the clinical practice stress. Not again, they use a term, clinical experience stress, and clinical practice stress was used all throughout the paper, and all of a sudden they throw in. And it is supposed to say that because up in the line at the above it, table 11, correlation between clinical practice stress, stress coping, empathy, and clinical performance. And this is one of the things that makes it kind of hard to read this, is when they do stuff like that. They replace that word, and I think that's a typo. They should put that in that first column header or second column header. It should say clinical practice stress. So this is a correlation table. And again, this is
I
looking
think
at,
this is the money though, right
yeah,
here.
this is their
It's
main.
yeah, I mean, if you're going to take something away from this paper,
Yes.
if you experience stress, your clinical performance is affected
Yep.
and your empathy is affected. Now, maybe they're like the chicken and egg thing you said was it's that the more empathetic you are, the more stress you have, or the less empathy you have, the better the less stressed. But it's highly correlated there and highly correlated to performance.
So this was sort of the main, and that's why I said in their research questions, they kind of left this part out. They talked about the impact of clinical practice stress, stress coping, and empathy, but they forgot to say, oh yeah, on the impact on clinical performance. And this was kind of the money, you know, does it affect the clinical performance? And the other, I'm just going to zip through the other three tables because they're, these ones here are really proofs of the model. So they're really kind of trying to prove the model of you know, the effect of clinical practice stress on stress coping and on stress coping on both on empathy and then again all three on clinical performance. And so this was like a proof of model. And their conclusion then was that higher clinical practice stress is associated with lower clinical performance, and higher stress coping and empathy were associated with higher clinical performance, which makes me want to ask you, Dr. Bill Toon and David Page, are these modifiable risk factors for clinical performance?
1,000% yes.
And so then where do we go from
Right.
here as
So if we give
educators?
them stress coping mechanisms, and I would say debatable as to whether this is a student responsibility or an instructor responsibility, because most of that coping stress came from unclear role, not supported, right? So that's a modifiable variable that we control. Maybe. This was a hospital-based study, so I have just a tiny bit of heartache about I mean, I think it's great. I think the authors should be celebrated that they're doing this with paramedic students who are attending hospital clinicals. Yay. And we often cannot affect a lot of change in departments that are, peripherally not directly at performing pre-hospital care. So hard to go into that environment and say to preceptors, you will want your students there. But I do think it's possible. Like we had nursing, nurse paramedics, or paramedics that later went to be nurses, be preceptors for groups of students in the ER so that there was an advocate for them. There's somebody who's, there if the faculty can come visit and make the connections and There's a little bit more shadowing of one-on-one or shadowing of the physician who's doing the decision making. So helping connect that student to that to decrease the stress would be good. But coping mechanisms, I don't know. I think we need to give our students more coping mechanisms for mental health reasons that far outweigh just the stress created by the clinical. It's
Very true. Bill?
A couple of just observations. One of the things is I think about this article is we're comparing an Asian culture, Korean culture, to us. And I think that there's fundamentally some differences right there with their culture compared to what we're most exposed to here in the United States. So I think that that's a factor. I really did like Dave's point there about the culture of the organization that these students are in. That plays certainly a big role. And I also agree. God, I can't believe I'm agreeing with him. I sometimes though think Dave uses the term coping, but is it also how do we inoculate, harden our, because there's a reality that we can't control, but they need to know how to harden their shell, develop more grit. And again, I don't, there is stressors in this environment. There's absolutely no question about it. Whether you be a student, ask any of my former students and they would tell you about stress. I feel guilty at times about it, but, that's a different therapy session. But I really do think that I think that we need it would be neat to reproduce this here in the United States. I think that that would be
I
that to
agree.
me is the important piece there, and then the comparison that could
I
take place.
agree.
I
There's
agree.
educators on this webinar right now who can reproduce this. So I'm expecting new projects to come forward, right?
And I agree. I agree. But I'm still looking at table three and staring at it and saying, just this week, I had two students talk about totally different experiences in the OR. And it wasn't about how many intubations or superglottic airways or bag valve masks they got. It was about the behavior of the staff toward them. And you know, whether or not they were felt like they belonged or were part of it or they didn't know their role or whatever, the same exact things it, line by line in that table. And that's in an area. So then it comes, there's so much about this that I'd love to unpack. So one of the things is, do we work on the site or do we work on and say this is the reality of the clinicals, and maybe we should get some empathy toward what, why are they like this? Why is the site like this? Is it because we're, you know, nobody's telling them they got a student coming? Is it because they've had a mistake in the past? Do we impart empathy on our students for the site behavior, and that improves their experience? You know, I'm really trying to think of all angles here. How do we, and that maybe that gets to coping mechanisms too toward the site. Because ultimately we want them, you know, we want them to have good clinical performance, but we also don't want them to hurt themselves on the way of having good clinical performance as well.
I'm so glad you picked this paper. Oh, sorry, Bill.
You know, and you've heard me mention this before. I really think one of the ways that you're able to improve that experience is you have to have your own employees in there to run interference and take some of the stress off the staff. And we did this both in the operating room. When we took our paramedics, when I worked at Johnson County Medac, we took our paramedics into the operating room. And my job as the education supervisor was to take care of all the orientation, what are the rules and practice. And you took that, we offloaded that burden from the staff, and it improved relationships amazingly. And then the student was then, not the student, but at that point there, the employee didn't have to, the employees all said very consistently, this was so different than my time when I was a student. You know, because they had that horrendous experience as a student. And I know I'm talking cost, but I'm a firm believer that one of the ways that you improve, you have to have your advocate there. And the way you have advocates is you have to pay them. I'm a big person about that. That's where things change, is when you can do that.
And or reward them, even if it's not financial, have some visible way of saying you're a leader, you're an advocate, you're an ally, and just enlist and exalt and foster a culture of excellence that says I'm going to stand up and protect and advocate for the student. And so, yeah, I do think we have a tendency with both preceptors, FTOs, to just think, yeah, whatever, you get a few more bucks an hour, or you get a pat on the back occasionally. But if there was ways to formalize some of that, I think there'd be better accountability, but also better participation and a stronger feeling of ownership over the student and the performance and their survival through this process, you know.
So this was food for thought, and I'm thanks for helping us with understanding the translation, how to get beyond translation issues and get to the real, it's real tempting to say, well, let's look at another article from a more mainstream journal because I'm having a challenge reading this. There was more to it, and it's such a great topic, as you can see. And congratulations to the researchers in Korea who published this, and we look forward to more research discussions. Thank you, David Page, Dr. Bill Toon, for joining this discussion, and join us next month, April 25th, 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central. We're going to be talking about a systematic review of the evidence for using simulation to replace clinical practice. This is in the International Journal of Paramedicine. If you haven't checked out that journal, it's a great journal. January through March 2025, you can look this up, volume 9, I guess. And the next PCRF Journal Club is Monday, April 14th. So you can join Dr. Remley Crowe, Dr. Tony Fernandez, and others, Dr. Bill Toon, and others, for a discussion of clinical practice as well. So to join us live each month, you can register at prehospitalcare.org. Don't forget to go there and look at some of the research opportunities. Think about, applying to one of the upcoming summits. Keep your eyes on the website and visit our YouTube channel so you can watch some of our prior episodes of the Prehospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. We will see you next month. Happy spring break to those who are on spring break. Bye-bye. We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past journal clubs can be found at www.pcrfpodcasts.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website at www.prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsor, Limmer Education, providing education tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey.